We're discussing Juneteenth, commemorating the end of slavery in our country, and how this history in 1865 in Galveston informs where we are as a nation today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. How do you feel about Juneteenth becoming the 12th legal federal holiday? What does this milestone mean for you and your community? The name, Juneteenth National Independence Day. How do you feel about it? What questions do you have about the emancipation of the last enslaved African Americans? It's 800-642-1234. Sakara Wages is a founding member of the Black Platteville Community Network. Sakara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Robert S. Smith, resident historian of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee and an associate professor of history at Marquette University. Robert, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Good morning.
Good morning. Robert, let's start with you. What significance does this commemoration for African Americans have today? What are you feeling?
Well, you know, it's a longstanding and important recognition of two fundamental realities that are directly connected. Obviously, the ending of the institution of slavery, but also the commencement of this long journey toward full citizenship. And as we've seen over the last year and several years and throughout that 150 or more year period, it's been difficult. It's been beleaguered. It's been tortured in so many ways. And so it's important to have a federal holiday to recognize it. But I'm sure we'll get into this. You know, Black people have been celebrating this for a long time.
Yes, indeed. Sakara, how are you feeling at this moment?
Yeah. So how I feel about the holiday, well, first off, let me just say I don't believe in binary. So while I do see value of it being a federal holiday, I definitely have issues with it. But for me, the way it speaks to our current situation is that it's the name of a movement that was necessary to enforce a policy. And so it's just really ironic that here we have, you know, a legislature, a piece of law, acknowledging that day as a holiday when we have such a robust history of ignoring laws when it comes to Black folks scrying for their rights for citizenship in this country. And so I just think it's a really ironic sort of way to acknowledge the holiday.
Oh, Sakara, seeing that contrast, that two-faced contrast, Robert, you know, as thousands upon thousands of people gathered in cities for protests, Black Lives Matter, the murder of George Floyd, and so many others. What impact do these events have on the collective view of Juneteenth?
Well, Juneteenth certainly has been a mainstay in terms of the run of holidays and celebrations that African Americans celebrated. You could see it express itself far and wide across the country in various ways. And so it stands as its own significance, independent of what's been occurring over the last several years. Obviously, the last several years have certainly amplified that fundamental question of, you know, are folks who are under the constant threat of state violence being treated as full citizens? And I think we all know that that answer comes back very, very challenging in a lot of respects. It forces us, the last several years has forced us to come back to that question over and over and over. And Juneteenth is obviously gained, I think, quite a bit more traction because of that. But it's been there for a long time, as we know. And so I agree with my other guests that we don't want to go so far as to put too much value on the federal recognition, which kind of took over in a very short period of time. You know, it was a pretty quick process, all things considered. What we really want to remember is that this has been a holiday that has been outside of the Hallmark engine. It's been a part of the oral tradition of African Americans. It's been a part of the longstanding ways in which folks celebrate and recognize what it means to be a full citizen on their terms and defined using their own meanings.
We're talking with Robert Smith, who teaches history at Marquette University, resident historian of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Sakara Wage is with us, founder of the Black Platteville Community Network, as we discuss Juneteenth, the meaning to the nation. How do you feel about Juneteenth being made a federal holiday? What does this milestone mean for you? 800-642-1234. Sakara, I want to ask you more about Black Platteville Community Network. What are you doing with this?
Yeah, so what we envision this is it is a way to sort of address the illusion of scarcity of Black folks in this area. So there's this illusion of scarcity as though we don't exist. And so the inception of our group was to bring us together and unite us. You know, and a backgrounded goal of that was to, you know, if you unite a group of people, then they can much easier strive for citizenship in a democracy, right? Mm. So that's how it started. But then throughout that, because we believe in emergence, and that is meeting the needs of our community when that shifts. And so following a lot of the events of last summer, we felt the need to have a restful space, right? Because we believe that rest is required for any sort of political, social fights for change, right? Mm. And because when you're oppressed, if you have no space to rest and recharge, then it's much more difficult to continue that fight. And so for us, a solution to, you know, getting some of the changes that we would like to see is providing a space for rest, recharge, community, and just joy, right, as fuel to continue.
Yeah, you know, that point you make, Black joy, you've been really expressing that and looking at what is Black joy. What are you seeing there?
Yeah. So what I'm seeing is Black joy has a functional purpose, right? It's not just an emotional state of happiness, right? As I've sort of hinted at earlier, one of the functional purposes is this resting and recharging, right? But the second reason that it's so important to me is I'm also a fifth-year PhD student, so I'm in institutions, and every time I walk into rooms, it's almost like they want me to be miserable, or they assume that I'm miserable. But when the reality is Black folks historically in this country have been oppressed and still found joy in their everyday existence. And so I study social welfare, and there's these deficited narratives that'll almost have you believing that these populations are miserable, and they aren't. They're, you know, they have happiness in their day-to-day life. And so part of my mission in my life is to help the larger community see that we have joy, and to help Black folks, you know, tap into that joy.
Robert Smith, your reaction there to Black joy and how you approach it and what Sakara is saying.
Oh, I appreciate all those comments so much, Sakara. You know, part of, you know, my lens associated with that and its connection with Juneteenth is, again, so much of how we come to understand Black identity is about how Black people define who they are, independent of institutions of racial oppression, independent, or and sometimes in spite of those mechanisms. And so Black joy is for me the longstanding decision to live life with full dignity, no matter what the circumstances. And that in and of itself is resistive. You know, and it's that kind of both internal and external expressions of joy, whether it's individual or familial or communal, that is also a very powerful source of sustenance. Mm. And also the ways that folks live a life with dignity such that you don't have to always worry about those oppressive forces. Those don't control and dictate every moment of your life.
What about resting and recharging, and the notion that there has been so much energy put forth by the Black Lives Matter movement and putting this, you know, and putting pressure on systematic racism, putting pressure on police brutality, that takes so much energy?
It does, and it's a fight that has been a mainstay in these United States long before there was a United States. And so the journey toward that precious understanding and actualization of full citizenship is indeed something that requires that one recharge, that one take some time off, reflect, think, love, and do all those wonderful things, and then get back to the fight.
We're discussing the significance of Juneteenth, now a federal holiday, with Marquette History Professor Robert Smith and Sakara Wages, one of the founders of Black Platteville Community Network, raising awareness, elevating Black voices, that network. Does this year's Juneteenth celebration have special significance because of the protests for the Black Lives Matter movement? How should schools teach about Juneteenth? Join in. Your reaction, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how to commemorate Juneteenth and where our nation is today as it marks a new federal holiday. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. You might call it Emancipation Day or Jubilee Day. Juneteenth commemorates the actual end of slavery in our country. How do you recognize African-American culture and freedom? What does Juneteenth mean to you? Join in, 800-642-1234. Marquette History Professor Robert Smith and Sakara Wages, one of the founders of Black Platteville Community Network. They stay with us. Tony is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Tony. What would you like to add?
Hi. Well, I am just commenting on your question of how we feel about this becoming a federal holiday. I personally always felt Juneteenth was more of a Freedom Day versus July 4th. It becoming federal makes me feel skeptical because often there's kind of a pretty bow, but no action behind things. So that's how I feel about that one. And I'm a little afraid that it's going to turn into a bar crawl like May 6th, you know, Mexican Independence Day, or something that's not taken seriously as it goes into the public. And with that, I'll take my question. Comment.
Tony, thank you. Sakara, pretty bow, no action.
That has been one of my commentaries ongoing, is that Dr. Smith said earlier, like, they did this process really quickly. So I see how quickly we, you know, things can happen in this country. And it's just extremely interesting that we choose this platitude over some real change as opposed to and some real change, right? There was obviously capacity to do so. So I am also worried that we will lose the spirit. It seems like co-option for me, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you co-opt things, you really lose the spirit. And so I think those were some of the things that Tony was speaking of, and I agree.
Robert, we have a history question coming in here from Elna in Madison. As Elna understands it, Juneteenth is when the slaves in Texas became free. Elna is asking, did slave owners inform the slaves of that or hide the fact that they were free?
Yes and yes and yes and no and no and no. Mm-hmm. There's such a rich history of this particular moment moving from the Civil War through the abolition of slavery and into Reconstruction. I think the first thing that I want to share with all of our listeners is that whether it's the Emancipation Proclamation, whether it's the 13th Amendment, and those two need to be discussed a little bit, whether it's either of those, it's not like Black people waited to be told that they were free. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for us to just completely remove that lens as the way to understand the ways that Black people begin to engage as free people. That those are very sometimes personal decisions. In some cases, it has to do with the physical presence of Union troops who then, you know, control a region and then make operationalize the Emancipation Proclamation. In some ways, it's directly related to the 13th Amendment. It really depends on where folks were in the South, the presence of a militarized force, and then also the ways that folks decide Black people in particular decide to engage the war effort, whether it's joined in the ranks of the military, playing roles that would not necessarily be seen what we would traditionally refer to as espionage. So there are a number of ways that during the Civil War and immediately post 1865, that Black people began to articulate freedom on their own terms. Mm. Now, of course, the militarized presence of the Union Army helps to make that more functional. And so that's kind of what we get in Galveston and other parts of the South. But it's not like Black people were waiting for the Union troops to arrive to be free.
You know, you mentioned the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, but you've also been really made a point of knowing your Constitution, knowing the laws. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Emancipation Proclamation is it's an executive order, wartime authority that President Lincoln has as commander in chief. It's only binding to states under rebellion. And so at the end of the conflict, the 13th Amendment is necessary in order to bring a functional end to slavery through a constitutional edict, through an amendment. And of course, what we know is that in 1865, there were varying interpretations of what Black emancipation and the abolition of slavery would mean, whether you're a Black person, a white Southerner, a white Northerner. There are all these differing and competing interpretations, such that we then are very much in need. We as a nation are in need of a 14th Amendment that clarifies that indeed folks are citizens. And so and we also know the tortured history of the 13th Amendment and the nefarious clause except as punishment for a crime, which mobilizes the criminal justice apparatus as a means of controlling Black labor and Black bodies. And so it is very important for us to know the Constitution. And also, it's important for us to always be mindful that people are going to use every potential resource at their disposal as a means of securing that dignity and that liberty and that emancipation and that freedom on their own terms again. And using the laws, using the Constitution has been one of those ways.
Mm. Robert Smith with us, Associate Professor of History at Marquette, Sakara Wages, founder of the Black Platteville Community Network. As we look at Juneteenth, the significance, the history, your insights, 800-642-1234. Sakara, as you look at this history and even Juneteenth aside, what are some of the current struggles that come to mind that roll into what you see Juneteenth being and the history of it being?
Current struggles that I see. I'm not certain I understand that question. The current struggles that are related to Juneteenth,
yes.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess we're still scrying. So one of the things that Dr. Smith sort of mentioned is this idea of that when nobody knew what, Black freedom, Black liberation, emancipation looked like. Mm. And so there were different operational definitions of emancipation. And I still think we have that precedent, right? So what's backgrounded there is there's this idea that that there is a way to define this word emancipation and that there is one correct way. And then you have all of these folks trying to figure it out incorrectly. Well, I think currently we have Black folks looking to be liberated. We're looking for abolition. We're looking for all of these solutions, right? And there isn't one way to do it. Mm-hmm. So backing up from that, what I'm saying is we need to tap into this like subjective sort of worldview and allow everybody's ideas and definitions to come to the table. So there's a relationship for me. And then I also think this idea behind that is this deficiency in cognitive bandwidth. So when you are oppressed or in slavery or under conditions beyond your control, it's hard to think, right? And so this goes back to, it's difficult. I'm not going to say impossible, right? But it's hard to think through some of these very tough problems. Mm-hmm. And so going back to providing rest and providing needing rest then and needing rest now, there's this need to recharge cognitive bandwidth such that we can apply those that thinking to these very difficult problems and create, co-create a new way of living.
Curious, Sakara, too, and Robert, how you would see Juneteenth celebrated, commemorated in a rural area such as, or a smaller community such as Platteville versus a larger city like Milwaukee?
You know, it's a really great question. And I don't have the precise answer, but what it really helps our listeners understand is that this particular holiday has been celebrated in very different ways across the country, whether that's in an urban space or a rural space. I've actually had the opportunity to celebrate Juneteenth in those differing environments. And while there might be some functional differing approaches to how the celebration manifests, it's still one fundamental issue, which is let's celebrate that fundamental question of liberation. And that thread runs through all of them.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Sakara. It was great hearing you.
Robert Smith.
Yeah, you're going to get an email from me.
Great. Robert Smith, resident historian at America's Black Holocaust Museum. Sakara Wages with Black Platteville Community Network. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the rich musical tradition and the power of African-American spirituals. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What an absolute pleasure to have ethnomusicologist Jonathan Overby. He broadens our musical horizons, brings us world music every Saturday evening as executive producer and host of The Road to Higher Ground on the NPR News and Music Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you have a favorite spiritual or one that lifts you up when you feel defeated? Do you sing spirituals in church? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Overby, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's actually my first time being on your program. Delighted to be here.
Oh, good, good. Well, first, some context. What defines a traditional African-American spiritual?
Well, I think before you jump into a definition of it, I think there's a backdrop that's important to present. And it is rooted to this amazing aspect linked to the history of spirituals, and how a massive group of enslaved people, shackled against their will, brutalized, were separated from their immediate families, crammed into the belly of ships, barely clothed, lying next to strangers. If they were fortunate enough to survive the Middle Passage, they were transported to a new but unfamiliar land where they were officially placed in bondage and forced to labor until death. And the second part of this is that once here, they were treated like chattel, where women were raped, where their children were sold off to strangers, where men were emasculated, where men and women were stripped of their ancient cultural norms and tribal heritage, and where both were compelled to embrace the Bible as a means to de-heathenize them or cleanse them of their past, their cultural past. And they were relegated to the status of not being fully human, and would in time come to create this music in this condition of bondage in a form that I believe is North America's first genre of original music, despite the reality that initially these people did not even speak English. In fact, many of them, perhaps a third, were Muslims whose language was Arabic. And so this backdrop is fascinating to the creation of this very important music.
Thank you for that sobering and incredibly important backdrop. You know, the spirituals, they have that call and response pattern. What influence do you see in the call and response in spirituals?
Well, that intimate detail of their formation is tied to the fact that they, these songs, grew out of an oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs rooted in the form of call and response is common to many cultures around the world. This is not a unique thing to anything with Afrocentric elements to it. But it is a cornerstone to the flavor of the music. More pointedly, I think it's good to note that these songs are strophic, and they're based on, in format, an anthem or hymn. Mm. And why that is because these folks, they were not slaves, they were enslaved. No one is born a slave. We're not allowed to sit inside some of these parish churches in the Deep South, but they were allowed to sit outside, and they would capture some of the narratives as they began to understand the English language and the relationship between those stories and biblical characters and narratives in the Bible that they eventually embraced. So over many, many decades and many generations, the music that you hear in the form of a spiritual is tied to what they heard inside those churches.
Mm.
And so they would reimagine these narratives in the form of identifying with the children of Israel, with the Hebrew children. And so their sense of freedom began to, if you will, walk along the same path as those enslaved Hebrews.
Mm.
And so out of that comes the underpinning for what created this music that's associated in many ways similarly to the Holocaust or to apartheid or any of the struggles in around the world in which people who are in a state of suffering find a way to elevate themselves past their condition, that even if they don't find freedom in this life, as many spirituals articulated, they look for it in the next life. So the call and response is a form, and it's an important aspect of it, but most of them are straight ahead, strophic, chorus, verse, chorus, verse.
Let's listen to Go Down Moses. This is performed by baritone Jubilant Sykes.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down.
His voice is so exquisite, so expressive, and I imagine an entire congregation singing the phrases, "Let my people go."
Well, that song is part of a category, a subcategory of spirituals that, as I've come to embrace them, that they fit into different categories under the umbrella of spirituals. You have sorrow songs, plantation songs, generally secular in nature, jubilees, and protest songs, which that one actually is. It's a song of protest. There aren't many in the canon of American spirituals. There are even spirituals that have double meanings, like Steal Away to Jesus. There are songs like I Feel Like a Motherless Child, which is a sorrow song. And even songs like Jimmy Crack Corn, which is a plantation song that actually grew into becoming part of the evolution of minstrelsy in the 1840s. And then there are jubilee songs in that great getting up morning. And of course, the protest song, Go Down Moses, and even more modestly crafted songs, because some of these songs had to be, they had to be sneaky in order to convey a message of a twofold message of wanting freedom, but also wanting to be freed from the bondage. And in some cases, these songs indicated a signal to escape.
Yeah, you know, freedom from the bondage and the story of the Israelites, Exodus from Egypt. You know, God sent Moses to Pharaoh repeatedly to carry that message, let my people go. And each time the, you know, Pharaoh refused. What do you see as this song also connected to Jewish Passover?
Well, that's digging a little deep into the weeds.
Okay.
I would say that the songs are more general in terms of narratives mm-hmm. that deal with biblical characters. So you cited Moses, a key figure. Who will be the leader? In fact, there was a phrase that circulated among those enslaved, and it would be, "Are you the one?" And it was a word when any of those enslaved saw someone within their circle on the plantation who seemed to embody that character of being the leader for leading them to freedom. And you saw their characters who are really important, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman. And when those names began to circulate around the parishes in the Deep South, it was common to say, are you the one who would lead them to freedom? So in that sense, there's an enormous connection to the perils, but also the actual eventual travels, the journey to freedom by the children, the Israelite children.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Overby, ethnomusicologist, executive producer, and host of Wisconsin Public Radio's The Road to Higher Ground. You can join in. Do you have a favorite spiritual? What do you want to know about the legacy of spirituals in American music? What connections do you have to spiritual music? 800-642-1234. How do you see these spirituals played today, whether it's in people's earbuds, whether it's in church? Where do they emerge?
Well, if you're asking me about where are they performed today, mm-hmm. I would say rarely are they performed. And when they are, they're most often rendered by a professional, classically trained artist, by and large. Let's remember that the vast majority of these spirituals were created by unknown bards. And quite amazingly, these melodies have lived on generation after generation for hundreds of years. And so they were very valuable to the settings with the emergence of the African-American church.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the church began to become more formalized, spirituals in the 1950s and 60s with the Civil Rights Movement were not as welcomed because they reflected on a time of suffering and bondage. And with that came the emergence of gospel music, which was much more optimistic. So you don't hear them much anymore. Some do. And one of the interesting things that I find about this music is that they're not folk songs, in my view. They're art songs.
Hmm.
And as you play that piece, it sounded in my ear like it was a piano that accompanied the singer. And that's most often how they're rendered. You don't hear many songs that are spirituals that are accompanied with a guitar, though you hear them in choral arrangements where they're in some cases a cappella. Now, that's not a hard and fast rule, but most often you'll hear them by classically trained, formally trained artists, operatic singers, if you will. And in some cases, they're fully orchestrated, thoroughly composed with this wonderful big sound behind the spirituals. But at their core, they're very simplistic songs in terms of their construct. In fact, some of them are arietas, and they almost lean into being arias with the bigness of them, like Ride on King Jesus, that piece that has this great atmosphere to it of someone of great stature coming to set the people free.
I wonder how you feel about the role of Amazing Grace. You know, I think of my experiences with spirituals, and I was attending a funeral at an African-American church in Louisiana, and they played Amazing Grace. They played Down to the River to Pray. Very, very moving. What do you make of Amazing Grace in particular?
Well, Amazing Grace is not a spiritual. Amazing Grace was actually created by a captain on a slave ship, if you will. Mm. And at a point in his life, a point during his travels, he became really depressed and disenfranchised from the work that he was doing. And he felt bad. He was having intimate relationships with the cargo, if you will, the women. Mm. And it turned him. And he even wrote that verse in there that saved a wretch like me. He felt so badly. I forget the captain's name. But the mood of what he wrote is really important. And there's one line in it, since you're asking about Amazing Grace, that saved a wretch like me. I've never been comfortable with that particular word, wretch. Mm. I don't believe anyone is created in that context. But he included it because he felt so bad about what he was a part of. And so that's the truth related to Amazing Grace. Of course, it's done in many settings all over the world. I particularly love it when it's done with bagpipes.
Mm. Wow. Dr. Jonathan Overby, he's traveled the world, brings diverse and inclusive music to his show, The Road to Higher Ground. We're exploring the power of traditional spirituals. What connections do you have to spiritual music? What song did you learn in choir or sing at church that moves you to this day? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. WPR's daytime classical music host, they've been exploring traditional African-American spirituals as part of their lineups. We're talking about the enduring qualities of spirituals in American music, their backdrop here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Jonathan Overby is here. He's hosted his show, The Road to Higher Ground, for 14 years, seeking out music makers, using music as a means to raise awareness of diverse groups worldwide. You can join in 800-642-1234. I'm wondering if you could set the scene for us on how music was used in the Underground Railroad, the lyrics that gave geographical hints for safer travels. What do you see in the music?
Well, I call it simply signal music. Mm. And these songs, without throwing out too many titles, I'll use the word, the song Steal Away to Jesus. And so this entire idea of not just for the Underground Railroad, but just to get off the plantation and to try to head north, it was a very clever way, I think, of signaling that there was a train about to take off. There's even the song, "This Train Don't Carry No Gamblers, This Train." And so all of these songs, in many ways, you can find a double meaning in them. Songs about trains or the trumpet sounds. Yeah, it's about a trumpet, but it's also a cue to gather because there is going to be movement away from the plantation. Or bells, or songs even about laying down a heavy load. Hmm. I mean, if those enslaved knew that that was the signal piece to gather in the middle of the night to seek a better place, then you would know that in advance. It was a call to gather. And so whether it was about heaven or death or home or the crucifixion, angels, Mary, Jesus, children of the Israelite children, these songs really also, I should say, included songs about the master, but it was not about the earthly one, but rendered to imply such to their oppressor. Hmm. And often, when they were heard, they were thought of as being wonderful songs. In fact, legend has it that the term spiritual was one that originates from a plantation overseer who heard those enslaved singing songs and just tagged the style, if you will, as songs that had spirit. Hmm. And so that term stuck. And it's, I think, very fitting. The other thing that I think is important is that African Americans didn't create this music on their own. What they heard standing outside, sitting around the churches, those parish churches, means that there is an opportunity to embrace the music for its parallel to Eurocentric sacred music. And I think that is an important aspect to this, in which all of us, everyone, can feel as though they have some ownership with the creation of the music.
Let's listen to Wade in the Water, and this is being performed by Ella Jenkins and the Goodwill Spiritual Choir. What do you hear there? Escaping slaves, a song telling them to abandon the path, move into the water?
Well, it's emblematic of Moses leading the children of Israel across the Red Sea. Mm. And it's saying to them, wade in the water. It's been parted for you. You can trust that you can find freedom on the other side. So it's important, I think, when you hear these spirituals, to see them with reverence and dignity, and not romantically, though I think you can celebrate them with dignity. And so if you know the narratives, many of the key narratives in the Old Testament, then when you hear these songs, you can, I see a relationship with the story of Noah. Hmm. I see the relationship between the song and what I hear about Moses.
I want to jump in here. Jane called from Willapack. I couldn't stay with us. Jane says she read a children's book by Rhonda Rutger and that the song Swing Low, Sweet Chariot was originally called Swing Low, Sweet Harriet, referring to Harriet Tubman, and wants to know if you have any insights there.
Well, I think Harriet Tubman is to be commended, remembered for the great work that she did, and to be celebrated as a womanist leader. Nothing diminishes that. I will say this, that Swing Low, Sweet Chariot was a song about death. Hmm. And that is the underpinning of that song. It is simply and directly about dying. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Now, that doesn't sound like a rally song. That sounds like a song that has a very funeralistic quality to it. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, quite a treat for me to look at these songs and see the diversity within the kind of topics that were covered and celebrated and related to biblical narratives.
Dr. Overby, such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure as well. Thank you for asking.
Dr. Jonathan Overby, host of The Road to Higher Ground on NPR News and Music Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have a link to the WPR Music blog post on spirituals. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.